Not sure how to begin when speaking on Tisha B'Av, what you say, except to apologize for the fact that I'm not Rabbi Spitz. But yeah, he found out last night at about 11 o'clock that he had a Levaya today at 2:30, so he asked me to fill in. And as it happens, I've given a shiur on the topic that he had selected, which is good and bad. It's good in the sense that that means I have notes of my own on it. Bad on the other hand, because I don't like giving a shiur twice, because if you don't really build it from scratch, then it's hard to have your head in it and so forth. So I hope that it will be worthwhile. The topic that Rabbi Spitz was going to speak about is the topic of Nachem, which of course we just said in Mincha. And the problem of saying Nachem post-1967, and really with each passing year, thank God, the problem becomes more glaring. So before we talk about the problem, we'll talk about what Nachem itself is. We know that it's a paragraph that's included in Shmoneh Esrei. It's included in the Bracha of Yerushalayim Ircha. I happen to have an art scroll sitter that was left up here on the Bima, and it's on page 240. And it asks Hashem to offer comfort to us. And the earliest appearance of Nachem that I am aware of is in the Talmud Yerushalmi. If you have the source sheets, you can see it in source number one. Rabbi Acha bar Yitzchak b'shem Rabbi Chiya de Tziporin. Rabbi Acha bar Yitzchak says, quoting Rabbi Chiya of Tzipori, Yachid b'Tisha B'Av tzarech lahazkir me'ein hama'ora. An individual davening on Tisha B'Av is supposed to mention the day. You have an element of the davening that is unique to Tisha B'Av. And how does he do so? Ma'o Omer, what does he say? Rachem, not Nachem in this edition, but Rachem, Hashem Elokeinu Barachmecha HaRabim Uvachasadecha HaNe'emanim. We ask Hashem, have mercy with your great mercy, with your great generosity upon us, upon your nation Israel, upon Yerushalayim, upon Yerushalayim, your city, and upon Tzion, the dwelling of your glory. Note the distinction between Yerushalayim and Tzion, because Tzion is in fact a reference to what? The Beis HaMikdash, right? Tzion itself is Har HaBayis, the Beis HaMikdash, the Temple Mount, not Yerushalayim. So have mercy on Yerushalayim and upon Tzion, the dwelling of your glory, the city which is grieving, desolate, ruined, and destroyed. Given into the hands of strangers, trampled in the hand of wicked people, which has been conquered by legions, desecrated by idolaters, and so forth. The addition is not exactly what we have, but it's relatively close in most respects. Interestingly, it appears twice in the Yerushalmi. It does not appear in the Bavli at all. The Babylonian Talmud doesn't have it. We do find it, though, as a standard text when we get to the Gaonim. I brought you from Seder of Amram Gaon. The Gaonim were asked by communities to prepare the order of davening, to teach them how to daven, what it is that's supposed to be said. And so Rav Amram Gaon, I brought you as one example. You can find it in Rav Sadja Gaon as well. In source number two, he says, "B'tisha B'Av arvis v'shachris u'mincha mispala shmona esrei kamo b'chol." He says, you daven a weekday shmona esrei, a regular weekday shmona esrei, Tisha B'Av night, shachris mincha, u'kshemagiyad v'lirushalayim ircha barachmim tashuv, and when you get to the bracha v'lirushalayim ircha, u'vnei osab binyan olim b'yameinu omer, .. Baruchat Hashem Menachem Tzion Ubonei Yerushalayim. He has this separate paragraph with a separate ending of Menachem Tzion Ubonei Yerushalayim. There are indeed some variations. One interesting variation is that in the Yerushalmi version, and seems to be reflected in Rav Amram Gaon's source as well, they're saying Nachem in every tefillah. We say Nachem specifically in Mincha. Right? Rav Soloveitchik used to comment that Tisha B'Av has no consolation until Tisha B'Av afternoon. There is no element of comfort. It's simply sheer grief. Tisha B'Av night, Tisha B'Av morning, and it's only in the afternoon that we can actually say Nachem, that we could speak of the possibility of consolation. That's reflected in some of the other changes after midday on Tisha B'Av as well. Another difference that we see over time is that the Yerushalmi version of it actually doesn't have a special ending. You would end the bracha of Baruchat Hashem Bonei Yerushalayim, whereas we have this edition of Menachem Tzion Ubonei Yerushalayim. There are a few other changes, but to get to the point, the key line that is in question is the line which you saw already in the Yerushalmi, which describes the city of Yerushalayim as Avela Chareva Harusa Shomema. It is described as being in mourning. It is described as being in ruins. It is described as being destroyed, desolate, given into the hand of foreigners, trampled by tyrants, taken by legions, desecrated by idolaters. And thank God, that's not what we see when we look at Yerushalayim today. It's not, you know, even the most pessimistic of people and the most anti-government and so forth of people cannot realistically apply this line to the city. And so we have a debate. What do I do when I have a tefillah? I have a prayer which describes something and davens to Hashem about something that, as far as I can tell, doesn't exist in our day. This is not a new question, right? And no one here is surprised by this question, I hope. Right? The question is not new. And the most famous potential proponent of changing Nachem was Rav Shlomo Gorin. And Rav Shlomo Gorin, writing in 1967, recommends a change of using the text of the Yerushalmi, which is actually more benign than the text that we see in our Siddur. There's a lot of debate surrounding what Rav Gorin actually said personally. I was an observer of a debate on a rabbinic listserv a couple of years ago in which there were sources brought from Rav Gorin's Talmidim, his students, Rav Gorin's daughter, all trying to determine what it actually was that Rav Gorin himself said. And I always said to myself, if I give the shiur again, I'm going to research that properly in order to be able to present it. But I didn't expect that I would have the turnaround time that I had for this. So I can't tell you definitively, well, this is what Rav Gorin said, or even this is what so-and-so said Rav Gorin said, but we know that he did offer different texts. Rav Chaim David Alevi suggested that we should use the past tense, meaning don't change the contents of it as much as say, this is a city which was desolate, which was taken by legions and so forth. Rav David Shlush, another Rav in Israel, said maybe it should be altered to refer to the Beis HaMikdash specifically. Don't refer to Jerusalem anymore. Refer specifically to the temple being in ruins. And then on the other hand, you have the position taken by Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, which I actually brought on the sheet from a couple of different places. If you take a look at source number 3, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook in 1967 said, Ein adayin makom l'shum shinuyim. He said, there is no room yet for any changes. He said, as long as we are not able to establish a Beis HaMikdash, the pain is still there. Even though the facts of the city are no longer the same, if you can't establish a Beis HaMikdash, the pain endures. So said Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook there. And then if you take a look at number 4, he said something that's a little bit different. Rav Shlomo Aviner is quoting his Rebbe, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. He says, Yerushalayim hi begeder bezuya v'shomema kol od lo nivna hamikdash. He says, Yerushalayim is in the category of being disgraced and desolate as long as the mikdash is not rebuilt. She'ikra Yerushalayim hi beis hamikdash. Because the essence of Yerushalayim is the beis hamikdash. What's the difference between source number 3 and source number 4? What's the difference between what Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook wrote himself in 1967 in number 3 and what's reported by Rav Aviner in source number 4? Yeah. Of the city. Exactly. In other words, in number 3, it's, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, keep on saying this. Whereas in number 4, what we're being told is, if you don't have a Beis HaMikdash, you don't have Yerushalayim. We could build all the malls we want and all the towers that we want, and we could have access to the Kotel and to the Har HaBayis. Sorry. We can have potential access. Nonetheless, if you don't have a Beis HaMikdash, the city itself is still considered to be degraded. And that's one of the arguments for not changing it. The Rav Soloveitchik was famously against the idea in general of creative liturgy and altering elements of the davening. But in this in particular, the Rav was against changing the text of Nachem. And his argument, an argument also brought by Rav Avadia Yosef, is that the addition is still fundamentally true because it refers to the Beis HaMikdash, going back to the first point made by Rav Tzvi Yehuda, that really it refers to the Beis HaMikdash. It's not really referring to Yerushalayim. If you take a look at source number 5, he says, this is the Rambam that we're basing on, the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah. He says, Mikdash refers to Yerushalayim as a whole, and Medina refers to the rest of the land of Israel. There, they're discussing blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah on Shabbos, and what one would do in the Mikdash versus what one would do in the Medina. And the word Mikdash, as it's used there, refers to Yerushalayim as a whole. So that really it's referring to the Mikdash. Even when we speak of Yerushalayim, what we really mean is the Beis HaMikdash itself, that halachic center of the city, that center of the identity of the city, which I want to come back to a little bit later. And so one argument not to change it is, it's really about the Beis HaMikdash. It's not really about Yerushalayim, the city. It's the Beis HaMikdash, the battery for Yerushalayim. That's really what we're talking about. Another argument is brought by Rav Avadia Yosef, and he says it's about the spiritual state of the people. As long as the people themselves are not in the highest spiritual state, we still should say Nachem because we're still missing something and we're still grieving. It's another argument. Part of the debate is actually not even about the contents of the text, but about the origin of the text. And this is a point that Rav Avadia Yosef makes. He makes a very interesting argument about who wrote Nachem. We've already said that the earliest text that we have, I believe, is found in the Yerushalmi. But take a look at source number 6. Rav Avadia Yosef says in his Tshuva's responsum on the topic, V'hine mavur besidur Rav Sadia Gaon, shebetfilos uvmatbeya habrachos, he says, basing himself on Rav Sadia Gaon, that the prayers that we have, the format of the brachos, the blessings that we have, rely on that which we have received from the prophets, from the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. Our prayers, he says, date back to the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, the Great Assembly, from the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, can he really be saying that Nachem dates back to the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash? The answer is no, right? The answer is no. How do you know it cannot be from the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash? Because there's a Beis HaMikdash. What are you saying, Nachem? What are you saying? The city that's desolate and in ruins and so forth. That can't be. So he explains what he means. He says, Shahayu lahem shnei sidarim bitfilos. They had two orders of prayer. Seder echad lizman malchus Yisrael, v'seder acher hamiyuad lizman hagalus. They had one siddur that they meant to use when they have a Beis HaMikdash. And we know about the various synagogues that have been found from the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. There's historical debate as to the extent that they were used and what they were used for. But the argument that he's making from Rav Sadia Gaon is that they had one siddur that they would use in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, and Seder Acher, another one, Hamiyuad Lizman HaGalus, which is meant for when there's no Beis HaMikdash anymore. Wow. You had a siddur that was ready for use, just waiting for the Romans to come along and destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Where in the world did you get this from? V'zeh al-pi masha amru. He says it's a Gemara in Nazir. Sheyodim hayu she'asid HaMikdash le'charev. That they knew that the Beis HaMikdash was going to be destroyed. Everybody knew that the Beis HaMikdash would one day be in ruins. The Gemara there is talking about the problem of a Nazir who took a vow to be a Nazir while there was still a Beis HaMikdash, and then the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and now he's stuck. Because in order to end his period of being a Nazir, to be allowed to cut his hair, to become Tamei, to drink wine, he needs to bring his karbanos, he needs to bring his offerings, which he thought he'd be able to do when he took the vow, but now the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and he's out of luck. Is he now stuck for life, or could we do Hataras Nedarim? Could we repeal his vow, saying when he took the vow, he didn't expect the Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed? Right? That's a reasonable argument, I would have thought. But the Gemara in Nazir that he's quoting says Everybody knew that it would be destroyed. Everybody knew that one day there would be no Beis HaMikdash anymore, and that therefore you can't make the argument that he thought there was going to be a Beis HaMikdash. And so that piece in the Gemara in Nazir testifies that there was an awareness that one day there would be no Beis HaMikdash anymore. And he says, Nimtza Shagama Nusach Shal Tfilas Nachem HaMekubal B'Yadeinu Midorei Doros Yisodaso Baharei Kodesh Al Yedei Raboseinu Anshei Knesses HaGedola. Therefore, he says, Nachem must be from that tefillah that they created in the second Beis HaMikdash, and it is untouchable. That which the Anshei Knesses HaGedola, the Great Assembly, did, a group which the Gemara describes as involving 120 sages, including Nevi'im, including prophets, you don't dare tamper with. It was there then. It's here until Mashiach informs us otherwise. This is not the only place, by the way, that we find that idea, that the Chachamim actually planned for a period without a Beis HaMikdash. It comes up in the discussion regarding Prozbul and Shemitah. Without getting into a long discussion that is inappropriate for Tisha B'Av, I excerpted one line from a Tosfos in source number 7. The Prozbul is supposed to be a document which takes advantage of a loophole such that loans that are due will be collectible even after Shemitah. They aren't canceled by the sabbatical year. So Tosfos writes in source number 7, Lo tikun Hillel Prozbul ledoro, shayhaya bizman abayis. He says Hillel couldn't create Prozbul for his day because in his time, it was the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore Shemitah was biblical, and therefore you couldn't create a Prozbul. Prozbul only works against rabbinic Shemitah, Tosfos argues. Elala achar churban, rather, Hillel created it to be used after the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed. Ramban looks at this and says, you're out of your mind. You can't say such a thing. That Hillel would have created a Prozbul saying this is meant to be used when there's no Beis HaMikdash. I mean, we're a people that doesn't like Ayin Hara. Can you imagine the Ayin Hara of here? I'm creating this document for you to use once there's no Beis HaMikdash anymore. So Ramban is very against that idea. But that's Tosfos' idea. So the argument that Rav Avadya makes is, you can't change it. You're not entitled to change it because this text is sacrosanct. That's his response. On the other hand, if I just go based on the Yerushalmi, then it's late. And in fact, you can see there are many alternative editions found in the Rishonim in early authorities that make it sound like for a text that was old and sacrosanct and not to be changed, it sure was changed an awful lot. We find multiple editions around historically. And in fact, we are taught that various prayers were changed to reflect the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Despite this idea that there was an old siddur that was just waiting to be used, nonetheless, take a look at source number 8 as an example. Ramban talks about our benching, right? Birkas HaMazon is de'oraisor de'rabanan, biblical or rabbinic. Biblical. The Torah says, V'achalta v'savato v'erachta, you shall eat, you shall be full, not today, other days, and you shall bench. Well, one of my biblical brachos that's in benching, because benching means the first three brachos specifically are considered to be biblical, one of them is Uvnei Yerushalayim, build Jerusalem. Does that mean that in the Beis HaMikdash's time they were saying, build Jerusalem, because it's a biblical bracha? So Ramban, in source number 8, says no. He says, V'chein amru bebirkas hamazon shu vaday min ha-Torah. He says, benching is biblical. V'chulan ein matbeyon Torah. He says, the text of benching is not biblical. Avon etztavinu min ha-Torah shenevarech achar achilaseinu. But rather, the Torah commands us to make a bracha when we finish eating. Kol echad kefi da'ato. Each one could do his own bracha. And then they came along and they established texts for us to use, and those texts were altered in Galus. So in other words, you had a text of Birkas HaMazon of benching, which included a bracha for Yerushalayim, and it included a bracha for a standing Beis HaMikdash. Post-Beis HaMikdash, that text was changed to reflect the loss, and they said, you know, now we better say Uvnei, ask God to rebuild it. And so the argument would go, Nachem should then be subject to change. Nachim should now be up to change now that we have Yerushalayim restored, so we should be able to change it. So again, just to sum up what we've said so far, we said that we have a text which first appears in the Yerushalmi, which appears in the times of the Gaonim slightly altered, and then later appears still with a variety of changes. And that come 1967, when Yerushalayim is under our control again, the question arises, should I change the text of Nachim so that it no longer calls the city a desolate city, a city that is in ruins, and so forth? And the argument to change it was made by serious leading rabbis in Israel, Rabbi Chaim David Alevi, Rav David Shlush, Rav Shlomo Gorin. Then on the other hand, you had serious voices that said not to change it. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, Rav Avadia Yosef, Rav Soloveitchik argued against changing it. Part of that debate, again, is content related, meaning is this really talking about the city or is it talking about the Beis HaMikdash? Or perhaps the city itself is considered desolate without a Beis HaMikdash? And part of it is history related. It's about who the author was and what that means for us. Was the author, this group, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, such that I don't dare tamper with it? Or is the author somebody later, and therefore I have more freedom, and the possibility floated by Ramban in source number 8, that even a text which is old could be altered when circumstances change. All of that is the first part of this. The second part of this, though, I think is equally important, if not more important. In terms of what you say, well, it's too late because the shul already davened mincha. But in the event that you're planning on coming to a later mincha, ask Rabbi Strauchler what you ought to do. But the question I have that still bothers me is, within the view of Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Avadia Yosef, that it's about that Nachim is about the loss that we have suffered and continue to suffer. If you want to tell me that it's about the Beis HaMikdash, that it's not about Yerushalayim, then frankly you're fighting uphill against the text itself. Because listen to the wording, right? If you have a sitter, you can find it on page 240. It says Ha'ir, the city. Ha'avela v'ha'chareva v'ha'bezuya v'ha'shomema, the city that is desolate, the city that is in ruins, the city that is degraded. If you meant Beis HaMikdash, we have many words we could use for it. You didn't need to say the city. It talks about the city that no longer has its residents dwelling there. There are no residents of the Beis HaMikdash. There are residents of Yerushalayim. And of course, the reference is all through it to the city itself, to Yerushalayim. I think it's very hard to defend the idea that this text is actually speaking about the Beis HaMikdash. I think rather what you need to say, if you're going to take that tack, is that it's about Yerushalayim, but in the absence of a Beis HaMikdash, Yerushalayim itself is flawed. That when there is no Beis HaMikdash, that changes something fundamental about the city of Jerusalem, and no matter how many towers we build, and no matter how many of us actually live there, no matter how great our sovereignty, absent a temple, absent a Beis HaMikdash, you're still lacking something within the city. And what I want to set out for you are four elements that we find are lacking within our own sources. The first element that is lacking when you don't have a Beis HaMikdash is Ben Adam LaChavero, relations between one Jew and another. The Rambam describes, the Maariv Tzchias and the Gemara Nida describe the beauty of having Jews join together from wherever we are scattered for Aliyah LaRegel. Three times a year for Yom Tov, we come together in Yerushalayim. As a matter of fact, the Gemara records an eyebrow-raising enactment that the sages made in order to encourage Jews to get together in Yerushalayim for Aliyah LeRegel. We know that there are various laws regarding purity and impurity, and that there are various laws regarding tithing your produce. And the laws themselves are complex. They're even more complex for us because we don't actually practice them on a regular basis, and therefore, you look at them and you get a headache in trying to imagine how people actually did this. I think it was probably a lot easier for people who practice this on a daily basis. Nonetheless, we're dealing with a set of complicated laws, and you have in the population people who care about them, and people who say, you know what, that's not the essence of my identity, you're not so careful. And then even among people who care, you have people who will get it right and people who will get it wrong. And as a result, there's a question of who exactly is credible, is trustworthy, to say that their produce has been tithed properly, to say that their produce has been kept tahor, has been kept pure. However, the sages decreed that the default at the time of Yom Tov in Yerushalayim is that everybody's produce is assumed to be properly tithed and everybody's produce is assumed to be tahor, is assumed to be pure, in order to enable everybody to celebrate as one, in order to enable everybody to celebrate together. It's a remarkable thing to do. The penalty for becoming impure and entering the temple, the Beis HaMikdash, for example, is high. This isn't a simple thing that they did, but they did it because they understood the unity that comes with being together at Aliyah LeRegel, when everybody comes together in Yerushalayim. Scratch the Beis HaMikdash, then according to most views, that scratches the mitzvah of Aliyah LeRegel. You lose the mitzvah of going to Yerushalayim for Yom Tov, and that unity is gone. That's on a basic level. The Sadi Gerer said something on a less literal level, perhaps. If you take a look at source number 9, Mishnah in Pirkei Avos lists 10 miracles performed for our ancestors in the Beis HaMikdash. However, the last two of the 10 actually refer to Yerushalayim. One is that nobody was bitten by a snake or stung by a scorpion in Yerushalayim. And then the 10th miracle that's listed is Lo Amar Adam Lachavero Tsar Li Hamakom Shalin Birushalayim. Nobody ever said to anybody else, I don't have any space. It's too tight for me to find a space to stay in Yerushalayim. It never happened that there was a lack of space in Yerushalayim. So the literal way to read that is there was always room. Just like in the Beis HaMikdash, even though they were packed together, when it came to Bow, everybody had space. So too, when they came to Yerushalayim, there was always space. But the Sadi Gerer Rebbe said, it's not that there was always space. It's that each person was happy with what he had. And no one said, ugh, this is too narrow for me. This is too tight for me. Everybody was able to get along when we had a Beis HaMikdash. One of the elements of Yerushalayim that is influenced by the presence of a Beis HaMikdash is Bein Adam LaChavero, how we relate to each other in terms of the gatherings for Aliyah LeRegel, for the pilgrimage for each of the Yamim Tovim, and in terms of the influence that apparently this has, the Beis HaMikdash has, on helping people to get along in the city. And in fact, of the many passages that we find in the Gemara that talk about why we lost Yerushalayim, why we lost the Beis HaMikdash, a significant chunk of them link it to the loss of that relationship between people. Once the relationships went bad, we lost the Beis HaMikdash. One example I brought you is in source number 10, when people said, I'm going to demand my rights. They were Ma'am Midivrayim Aldin Torah. They said, I know my rights under the Torah, and this is what I'm going to demand of others. At that point, Hashem says, it's over. So that's one. That's one loss. And it's one reason to continue to say Nachem for the loss of Yerushalayim. Even when it's built, without a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have the same unity. Second, Bein Adam Lamako, the relationship between the Jew and God. And this is based on a Yerushalmi. If you take a look at source number 11, from the last chapter in Eicha, Zikenim mishar shavasu, bachurim mineginasam. The elders were no longer at the gates. The youths stopped their music. So you could read that line and say it's a conjunction. Two things happened. The elders, which by the way, the Targum there says is the Sanhedrin, the sages, are no longer at the gates, and the youths are no longer singing. You can read it as an and. However, the Gemara reads it as causation. A caused B. When there's no more Sanhedrin, then the youths don't sing. Take a look at source number 12, as it appears in the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. Misha batla Sanhedrin batal hashir mi beis hamishtaos. When the Sanhedrin ceased, there was no more singing in the party houses. And he quotes the pasuk from Yeshaya, from Isaiah, Bashir lo yishtuyayin, they will not drink wine with song. And they ask, how do you know this was when the Sanhedrin stopped? And they build it off of the pasuk here, that the elders ceased from the gates and the young men from their music. So once the Sanhedrin stopped, then there was no music. Well, I could read that as simply saying, if there's no Sanhedrin, then they stop celebrating and they stop rejoicing and they stop being as happy as they were. But take a look at what the Yerushalmi says in source number 13. Abba Barav Yirmiya Omar, Zekeinim Mishar Shavasu, etc. Amar Avchista, I should really start from there. Amar Avchista, Barishona Haisa Emas Sanhedrin Alehen, V'lohayu Omrim Divrei Nevala Bishir. He says, in the beginning, when you had a Sanhedrin sitting in the Beis Hamikdash, that affected the atmosphere of the city. When you have the 71 leaders who convene in the Beis Hamikdash, and when they're not convening in the Beis Hamikdash, then they're walking about your city. You see them in your stores. You ride the bus with them. You see them in the market. That has an impact on the city. At first, the awe of the Sanhedrin was upon them. V'lohayu omrim divrei nevala bashir. They didn't say repellent things in their songs, meaning that the songs themselves were pure. Aval achshav, but now, she'ein emas Sanhedrin aleihen. Now, loss of the Sanhedrin, there isn't that respect anymore. There isn't that awe anymore. Then, hein omrim divrei nevala bashir. It's not that the songs stopped, but the songs changed. The songs became a little bit more coarse, a little bit more corrupt. There wasn't that sense of awe anymore. That's what the Yerushalmi suggests. When you have a Beis Hamikdash, you also have a source of awe. It's not only this Yerushalmi. We find the idea expressed in the Sefer HaChinuch as well. Talks about the mitzvah of Maaser Sheni and the mitzvah of Kerem Revai. Right? What's the law of Maaser Sheni? What am I supposed to do under the mitzvah of Maaser Sheni? Sorry? In the mitzvah of Maaser Sheni, there's produce, right? I bring produce to Yerushalayim. I take, right? I'm supposed to take 4 years out of every seven. I'm supposed to take produce of mine, 10% of it, and bring it to Yerushalayim to eat. Right? If the trip is too far, then I'm able to redeem the produce for cash, bring the cash to Yerushalayim and buy food there and eat it there. But ideally, I bring the produce to the city. Either way, it means that we are all supposed to end up in Yerushalayim with our produce 4 years out of every seven, aside from Aliyah L'Regel when I go for Yom Tov. In addition, the mitzvah of Kerem Revai, that the fourth year of my vineyard, I'm supposed to take the grapes and bring the grapes to Yerushalayim. The Sefer HaChinuch says, we want to make sure that Jews are going to spend time in Yerushalayim. When you go to Yerushalayim, he doesn't mention the Sanhedrin, I believe, if I remember correctly. He mentions the Kohanim. You encounter the priests. You encounter the Levim, people who spend their lives in the Beis HaMikdash, who conduct themselves in a certain way. And it rubs off on the rest of us. There's value to associating with those who inhabit the Beis HaMikdash, whether it's the judges of the Sanhedrin or whether it's the Kohanim and the Levium. He also notes, similarly, that the Kohanim and Levium, when they weren't in Yerushalayim for their shifts, had designated cities, right? How many cities are there for the Kohanim? Right, 48 cities, 42 plus the six that are the cities of refuge. Right, so 48 cities. One of the keynotes, in fact, that we said this morning lists the cities of Soloveitchik. Used to say that that's the only place where we have in all of our literature a complete list of the cities of the Kohanim. So you have these cities scattered around the Jewish people. One of the ideas of having these cities scattered around, instead of saying Kohanim, you live here, is because they're supposed to be an influence. Well, if they're an influence when they live scattered among the nation, they're certainly an influence when they're at home in Yerushalayim, in the place where the Beis HaMikdash is. You lose the Beis HaMikdash, you lose that influence. Interestingly, I brought you source number 15. If you take a look at source number 15, Gemara in Bava Basra talks about the founding of Jewish schools, the system set up by Yehoshua ben Gamla. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Rav Yehuda said, quoting Rav, Bram Zechor Oso Ha'ish Latov, remember that man for the good. The Yehoshua ben Gamla Shemo, his name is Yehoshua ben Gamla. There are actually various stories with Yehoshua ben Gamla, but I'm going to stick to this one right now. This Yehoshua ben Gamla, She'el Malehu, if not for him, Nishtakach Torah mi Yisrael, Torah would have been forgotten from Israel. She'betchila Mishi Yeshlo Av Melamdo Torah Mishe'en Lo Av Lo Hayalome Torah. Initially, if you had a parent who could teach you Torah, that's how you learned. You didn't have, you're out of luck. Hiskinu shum oshivin malamdei tinokos b'Yerushalayim. Then they changed it and said, you know what, we're going to set up teachers in Yerushalayim, and that way, parents would bring you to Yerushalayim, and there you would learn. Then they realized that didn't necessarily work, because not everybody had parents who could bring them to Yerushalayim, and they said, all right, we'll make local schools. So what you have is this two-step process to get us to a system of public schools. The first step is, let's do it in Yerushalayim. And then the second step is, let's make them in every city. But what was Yehoshua ben Gamla thinking in that initial step? Why take them to Yerushalayim? Isn't it obvious that if you have a problem in which people who are scattered all over don't have access to Jewish education, isn't it obvious that you make your cities and the places, you make your schools in the cities where they live? Why did he say, let's do it in Yerushalayim until it didn't work? What's the reason? Sorry? The influence of the city. It's all about the influence of the city, what it means to be in Yerushalayim. And Tosfos makes the point, it's source number 16, the Hebrew's on the bottom of one side, the English is on the top of the next side. He writes, you could see the great sanctity, the Kohanim involved in the service. This in and of itself would be an influence. So that we now have two ways in which Yerushalayim is desolate, even built up, if there's no Beis HaMikdash. One, you lose the unity of the population that would come about via the gatherings in Yerushalayim and mystically as well. And number two, you lose the influence that a Beis HaMikdash has on the people who reside there. When you have the judges of the Sanhedrin, when you have the Kohanim, there's a potential for great influence. And then third, and this is a thought from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein that I found very powerful in an article entitled Jerusalem Between Holiness and Purity. If you take a look at source number 18, you find instructions regarding certain karbanos, certain offerings. Kichuas hamincha noseres me'yishay Hashem. The Torah says, I think it's Parshas Shemini, take the mincha, take the flour offering which remains from the fires of God, v'achaltem osa b'makom kadosh, and eat it in a sacred place. The sacred place is a reference to the Beis HaMikdash. At that point, the Mishkan, then the Beis HaMikdash. Ve'es chazea tenufa ve'eshok hatruma, and then parts from various offerings, these are called kadshim kalim, low-level offerings, tochlu b'makom tahor, you shall eat in a pure place, so that there are certain things which have to be handled in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple, and that's described as a holy place, and then there are other items which are handled in Yerushalayim as a whole, and those are described as being in a pure place. Why is one a holy place and the other a pure place? So take a look at source number 19 from Rav Aaron. He says, a makom kadosh, a holy place, is an area detached from day-to-day life, designated exclusively for matters of absolute holiness, kedusha. Activities associated with the ongoing existence of the individual, however acceptable and spiritually significant they may be, have no place in the Azara, in the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash, the temple, is isolated. You don't eat there. You don't sleep there. It's set off from daily life. That's the holiness of the temple. However, in the camp of Israel, Machne Shlishi, Jerusalem, the commitment to the Almighty and his service is not expressed through a detachment from the general exigencies of human existence, nor through a dissociation from the everyday mundane matters of life. The holiness of Jerusalem is not seen in separation from daily life. It's a mundane city. People live and function with this, the same things that we do in our lives. They eat, they sleep, they engage in commerce. It all happens. The camp of Israel, the same region that lies off limits to the Metzora because of its inherent spiritual quality, is also an encampment of banners and marching soldiers. He's referring us here to the Jews in the Midbar, in the wilderness, on their way from Egypt into the land of Canaan. And the camp where the Jews live, that outermost ring, is a place which on the one hand is called holy to the extent that someone who is impure is not allowed to be there, like the Metzora. But on the other hand, you have soldiers there. You have life there. These activities, however, are conducted in the shadow of the temple with a clear sense of standing before God with the rigorous standards of a makom tahor, of a pure place. In other words, what he's getting at is that Yerushalayim has a dual status. On the one hand, it's a place where people live. It's a normal city. But on the other hand, it surrounds the Beis HaMikdash, and that conveys a certain status to it, and it's a certain halachic status to it. And all the laws that we have for Yerushalayim, that you eat from certain karbanos there, like is reflected here in what we saw in number 18, that the kachim kalim, the low-level karbanos, are eaten there. The fact that my sersheni, my tithe, is brought to Jerusalem to be eaten there, that is a function of being in front of God, as he puts it, in the shadow of the temple. So there's another element that is missing. Even though the city is built up, you don't have all those laws that come with being in the shadow of a temple that make it a makom tahor, that make it a pure place. And then fourth and last, the beauty of the city itself, the wealth of the city, the beauty of the city is lost. And it may seem like a mundane thing, but that's what we're describing here. We're describing a city that is considered desolate. I brought you an example of it in source number 20, the parade they used to hold when the farmers came to bring their first fruits to Jerusalem. Those who lived nearby brought figs and grapes. Those who were more distant brought dried figs and raisins. Oxen walked before them, horns plated with gold, olive wreaths on their heads, the chalil banging before them until they neared Yerushalayim. Then they sent messengers before them and decorated their fruit. The officers came out to greet them according to the status of those who were entering. Every tradesman in Yerushalayim stood up before them and greeted them, "Our brothers from whatever place, you have come in peace." The chalil was struck before them until they reached Har Habayi, the Temple Mount. At that point, even King Agrippa put a basket on his shoulder and entered until they reached the Azara. They get to the temple. They get to the Beis HaMikdash. The beauty of the city, I noted it as well in source number 21, but the beauty of the city is lost as well. In Eicha, Yirmiyahu says, "Eicha yu am zahav," the gold has been dimmed. And we understand it on one level as a reference to Yoshiyahu, but it's also a reference to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, which in the Mishnah's time itself is called the city of gold. It's back then, it's not just in the song. And that gold is dimmed, the gold is covered, the gold is changed. The relations between people have changed because you don't have the same points of unity gathering everybody to the city, gathering everybody to Yerushalayim. The relationship with God has changed because you don't have the role models, the judges of the Sanhedrin, the Kohanim, the Levim. The sanctity which generates the laws of Yerushalayim is not there. The physical beauty that comes with all the fruit that was brought, the parades, the celebrations, that's not there as well. And all of that weighs in on the side of saying that, yes, Nachem remains relevant. You know, we live in an odd and uncomfortable era. I sort of think of it as Shabbat Chazon, or perhaps more appropriately, even like yesterday, which was Shabbos, and yet it was Tisha B'Av. It's Shabbos. We can live in Yerushalayim. We can daven close to the site of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. And yet, It's also chazon. It's a time that lacks the Beis HaMikdash. We lack the beauty. We lack all the elements that I just described. So now is the time for us to be metaken these elements, for us to repair these elements, to demonstrate our desire to return to the Beis HaMikdash. If I don't have the unity that was developed when people gathered for Aliyah LaRegel, that doesn't mean that we can't work on unity. We still can. If I don't have the relationship with God that I would have had if I was exposed to the judges of the Sanhedrin and the Kohanim who work in the Beis HaMikdash, that doesn't stop me from working on my reverence and my awe. If we don't have the beauty of the city in terms of the fruit that was brought, that doesn't stop me from investing in building up the city of Yerushalayim. Those are still possible, and those are still our mandate. As I said in the beginning, Rav Soloveitchik contended that reciting Nachem itself is an act of nichum. It's an act of consolation, and that's why he claimed it had to wait until the afternoon of Tisha B'Av. You can't offer comfort when, as the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says in source number 22, Meso Muta Lefanav, when the corpse is still there. It's a post-chatzos message. It's a message for after midday, when the building is already burning, but we understand that we are going to survive. It's up to us to recognize the problem, to recognize what we have lost, and to commit ourselves to correct it. May this be the last year that we have to convene here for Shiurim of sadness on Tisha B'Av. Next year, may we have Shiurim of joy.